We're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and I have one announcement looking ahead that I want everybody in this audience to know about, and then I want you to pass it on for me. Our final Tuesday evening presentation for this fall is on November 19th. So we have tonight, next week, and then the following week, and then we're done for the fall season. So in 2 weeks, Gustavo Artigas is going to be here. Gustavo has two works featured in Mexico Inside Out, one of which is Vote for Demolition, a participatory piece that I know many of you have participated in by voting, and it has a virtual demolition, which is going to happen for the chosen building, and that's going to happen for that final Tuesday evening presentation. So this kind of wonderful finale that relates directly to the exhibition, and in fact is kind of an extension of the exhibition. But to avoid an unforeseen conflict with a lecture by Renzo Piano, which is scheduled for the same night and at the same time, we have rescheduled Gustavo's talk, and I think this is going to work out perfectly. His lecture / demolition is going to be 5:30 to 6:30. And that will give everybody 30 minutes then to walk over to the Will Rogers, and lucky you who are here because you have parking. But also, I also think that this is kind of serendipitous, because what an incredible thing to have the virtual demolition of a building and then the presentation of the addition to the Kimball. So please mark your calendars and tell your friends. Mexico Inside Out, which was curated, of course, by our own Andrea Carnes, with the assistance of Allison Hurst, has made for such a rich resource for these Tuesday evening lectures. I'm personally very, very thankful, and I think all of you are as well, and tonight certainly is no exception. Two of the most popular pieces in this extremely well-received exhibition are the video installations by artist Joshua Okan, who has graciously agreed to be here tonight. Joshua, like many of the artists in the exhibition, was born and raised in Mexico City. He left to study art at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada, where he received a BFA in 1994, only to return and open La Panaderia. I just butchered that. I believe it means bakery, because that's what it was. An artist space for exhibitions, meetings, and gatherings, which rallied an entire community of artists and students. A very exciting endeavor, to say the least. And then, with a Fulbright scholarship, Joshua went on to get his MFA from UCLA in 2002. But he maintained Mexico City as the base from which he has developed a very exciting and successful international career, with group and solo exhibitions literally spanning the globe. Recent solo exhibitions include Joshua Okan, Octopus, at a Corner House in Manchester, England, this last spring, and Advisory, Conciliation, and Arbitration Service at the Hayward Gallery in London, as well as Latex at the Foundation of Alumnos 47?
Mm-hmm. Alumnos, yeah.
Alumnos, there we go. Alumnos, mm-hmm. 47 in Mexico City, both of which were just last year. And the list goes on, with no less than 7 solo exhibitions in 2011, from Lima, Peru, to Milan, to Buenos Aires, to Sao Paulo, to Mexico City, to L.A. He's a very, very productive and busy artist. And his work was included most recently in this year's California Pacific Triennial at the Orange County Museum of Art. Having also been included in important group exhibitions throughout his career, for example, Adaptive Behavior at the New Museum in New York, Mexico City, an exhibition about the exchange rates between bodies and values at PS1, then went on to the MoMA, or PS1 and MoMA in New York, and then went on to the Kunstwerk in Berlin, and the 2003 Istanbul Biennial, just to name a few. An exhibition record which is reflected in a very impressive public and private collections which own his work, including the Tate Modern, the Centre Pompidou, Hammer Museum, LA County Museum of Art, the collection of Humex, among others. And he has been recognized with the Art Matters Award in 2011. And the 2010 to 2003 SINCA, the National System for Art Creators, among other grants and awards. I'm not exaggerating when I say that Yashua's exhibition record and resume in general is highly extensive, and I want to get to tonight's to tonight's presentation, so I'm cutting it short with a great deal of regret. In addition to being an artist, a maker of work that has been described as something like a series of near sociological experiments and questions, which questions habitual perceptions of reality and truth, selfhood and morality, Yashua is considered a cultural innovator, as is evidenced by his commitment and involvement in causes, efforts that he believes in. Some such involvement includes being an advisor for the National Foundation for Culture in Mexico, an artist council member for the Hammer Museum in LA, an artist council member for SOMA. And SOMA is an amazing and important alternative school which Yashua founded in Mexico City along with some other artists to fulfill a need among artists and students there. We really are very fortunate tonight to benefit from such a richly developed perspective and a sincere passion. So please join me in welcoming Yashua Okon.
Okay, thank you. It's a huge pleasure to be here. It's been really great working with all of you, with you know, Alison, Andrea, Terry, etc. And so I will try to give an show many pieces and give an overview of my practice as much as I can fit in this hour. Please feel free to raise your hand at any given time and ask questions if you have them. You know, you can interrupt me. So I will try to be chronological. So I will start by one of the pieces included in this show, which is called Orillas a la Orilla. That piece is a series of videos in which I invite policemen to come to my studio in Mexico City, and then I shoot videos with them. So the idea was to... Oh, sorry. Let me... Okay, sorry about that. We'll get to see it in a second. like I was saying, I would go to my studio in the morning and then grab my camera, and then on the way to look for a policeman in the street, I would try to come up with an idea, find a policeman, and then ask him to go back to my studio and ask him if he wanted to participate. In some cases, they said no. Mostly, they said yes. So these are some of the results. So I'm sure a lot of you have already seen it in the exhibition, but I'll play a little bit of the number one of the series, and then feel free to ask any question.
Mira, me estás perjudicando.
Yo tengo abogados.
A mí tus abogados y tus papás me los paso por ahí. Pues sabes que ya sácate la goma. En serio, llégale a la verga.
Oye, pero ¿por qué? Yo no estoy haciendo nada.
Llégale a la verga, no sabes lo que es.
Tranquilícese.
Mira,
usted está aquí para cuidarnos y se debería de tranquilizar, ¿no?
Mira, voy a pedir más unidades. Y si no, yo mismo te voy a romper la madre. Ya, sácate de aquí, pinche marismo. Pronto. Ese güero, ya sabes a chingar a su madre, cabrón. Me cae de madre que hasta que no les parte uno la madre entienden. Pinches vagos arrogantes, poca madre, hijos de la sociedad. La sociedad ya está harta de ustedes, cabrón.
Al revés, está harta de ustedes que nos deberían de estar cuidando.
Gente
nada más
ustedes,
me están viendo.
Por eso nos está llevando la chingada, farmacodependientes, drogadictos. Ya sácate a chingar a tu madre.
¿Qué, oficial?
Porque lo que va a pasar es que te voy a romper la madre.
Yo puedo firmar.
Es que no entiendes, tú no puedes firmarme a mí.
¿Por qué
soy
no?
un servidor público, cabrón.
Quiera.
Vete a firmar a tu
Pero
pinche
no
madre o a
delito.
Tus hermanas.
Yo no cometí ningún delito.
¿Cómo
oficial?
No? En la forma que me estás hostigando,
usted.
Estás perjudicándome. Es más, llégale, porque me vas a hacer.
Tranquilícese, ¿no?
No, pues ¿por qué te voy acá?
Por favor.
Es más. Mira, bro, ya sácate a chingar a tu madre. Pareces joto, pinche marisco.
¿Qué pasa? Oiga, más respeto.
No, llégale de aquí, me cae.
Más respeto, oficial.
Lo que pasa es que te voy a romper la madre y todo va a pasar.
¿Pero por qué? Yo no he cometido ningún delito.
Bueno, ¿qué es lo que quieres?
Si
¿qué es lo que quieres? ¿Qué es lo que
yo
quieres?
Yo puedo firmar si yo quiero.
No, no, tú no vas a firmar a nadie.
¿Por qué no?
Vete a firmar al zoológico.
Le voy a poner una demanda.
Pues a mí me... Las demandas me las paso por el arco de Belén, cabrón.
Pero...
Mejor ya sácate a chingar a tu madre porque
por
me van...
de la ley.
No, estás equivocado.
Tranquilícese. Pero yo no estoy haciendo nada.
¿Cómo no?
Que yo puedo firmar si yo quiero.
Si yo no soy artista, yo no soy artista.
Pero yo...
Te vuelvo a repetir, vas a hacer que me cabrone y me regrese, te voy a darle la madre y aparte...
Pero ¿por qué me ofende usted?
¿Por qué está?
Anyway, I'll keep moving so that I can put more work into the lecture. Is there any question at this moment? Yes.
What was your arrangement with the
Yes. Yeah, the arrangement was very straightforward, and I work with non-actors. Or in other words, people that in a way perform themselves, but also play fictions, kind of taking as their own personas as a point of departure. So I normally go, just approach and people and try to be as straightforward as possible. So I approached the policeman and I told him, I'm an artist and I would like to make a video with you. Are you interested? Would you like to come to my studio? And then I offer a fee, of course, for their time. And that's pretty much it. It's very straightforward.
So was he playing a role there? Was that him playing a role?
I mean, one of the aspects that I'm interested in this series is to really play with this line between fiction and reality. In other words, it's kind of very hard to understand where one begins and the other starts. So I really wanted, viewers to really ask themselves, to what degree is he acting, to what degree is he being himself, and I could not really give you the answer. Of course, it's fiction in the sense that he came to my studio, but at the same time we didn't have a script, so it's completely improvised. So, sometimes I think that the camera makes sometimes people behave in more real ways than not, because the camera is like a license where you can really say what you think. So it's really up to you to determine to what degree is this real or not. Uh-huh. Okay, any other question? Yes, back there.
Look, you're not blonde.
Uh-huh.
You're not blonde.
Yes. Well, the term blonde in Mexico is very different to the term blonde here. It's a very relative. So, I mean, blonde, it has more class connotations than race connotations in Mexico. I remember I had like a black friend that once went from New York that went to visit to Mexico, and we went to a market and somebody called him blonde. So, you know, that tells you, you know, how I mean, if you're going to a market, the people buying can be referred to as blondie. But I mean, I'm really light skinned for general population. I'm more towards the light skin side. So that's why he calls me güerito, which is. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other question? Okay. So I will. Window. Okay, so I will move to a different series of works. There it is. Sorry, I'm trying to get used to. I didn't do anything. Oh, there it is. Okay. Okay, so this is a piece I made in 2000. I moved to Los Angeles to do an MFA at UCLA, and then I shot this piece called New Decor. For it, I went to a furniture store, and I asked the owner of the furniture store if I could shoot a soap opera in his store. I went into the store and it had a lot of really great props that he used to kind of present the furniture. So I really liked the place. And the guy was really, really nice. And he said, okay, sure, go ahead, just as long as I can keep open. And, I told him it's perfect because I wanted to have your customers be the actors of the soap opera. So it worked out well. So I was there for 5 hours with 3 cameras. And then basically the people that walked into the furniture store, I had people helping me and we talked them into participating. So I'll play a little bit and then I can talk more about it. On the right-hand side, you can see the piece is presented as a 3-channel projections, and they're like back screen projections. So they're like 3 freestanding screens. Where you can see 3 angles of the same action. So, and this is 2001, so it's 2 years after the Policeman series.
You short fucking piece of fucking shit. Ooh! Stupid. Look at the ear. Just came from. Ooh! It's so fucking. Another one to give this thing to me, or only a short piece of shit. She couldn't even wear a dress on my way, you know, she wore a stinky piece of shit, second-hand Lenny Leader suit.
Sorry, I will play the. Sorry, guys, I'll play the single channel version. Because it's easier to see. So we will be watching the center channel.
Piece of fucking shit. Ooh. Stupid. Look at the ear. Ooh. So funny. Another one to give this thing to me. Or only a short piece of shit. She couldn't even wear a dress on my wedding. You know, she wore a stinky piece of shit second hand. Lenny Leader suit. Ooh! Stupid woman. But no, her son Troy and he had to get a dress. Ooh! She wore a dress with his wife. No, she had to wear a funny fucking dance at Troy, bitch.
You find a word. Take the car away from you? Do you want me to sell the house and then spend all the money in Miami, New York maybe, perhaps France?
Get out of here, my house. This is right here, my house.
Now.
Let's go. Let's go.
Oh, I'm gonna throw this one.
Give me my head.
Get her clothes and get her out of here now. Right now.
Oh, come on.
No, no, no.
Come on. I'm sorry.
Get her out of here.
I'm sorry. I love you.
I'm sorry, Vanilla. What? You're a fucking crook, you know that? And you suck. You suck. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? If you want me to lose weight, I'll fucking lose weight. If you want me to wear high heels, fuck, I'll wear high heels. If you want me to dye my hair, I'll fucking dye my hair. What is it?
You want me to do that? I mean, it's up to you. You know, I can even sell the furniture in no time. Okay? And you know what? As soon as you walk out of here, there's another girl walking in here. And better than you, better looking. And if you say that I'm getting fat, that I'm getting lazy, it's because of you. You haven't been treating me the way you should as a woman. But you know what? From now on, I'm not going to take it from you anymore. You can always walk away, baby.
Are you not going to listen? Put your clothes back on, you dirty broad. You and your sick movies.
Shut up!
You're an ugly piece of shit.
Anyway, it's 17 minutes long, so we just saw an excerpt. Any questions about the soap opera? Okay, so I'll move on.
By the way, I do have a question.
Sure.
So those were all people that just came into the store to look at furniture and just
stumbled into your movie, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, in one case, they were just walking by in the street, but they're basically, it's people that we just found there on that day. There was no script. Basically, my directions were think about soap operas and think about your own life. And then once I started acting, then I would like sometimes throw other ideas. But it was completely done on the spot. There was no script. So for instance, the lady with the rabbit, she had recently gotten a divorce in which her husband told her that he wanted a divorce over the phone. So she reenacted the phone call. That's how it all began. And then she hated her mother-in-law, so then she kind of took the rabbit as the mother-in-law and took it from there.
I think she felt better afterwards.
Yes. Probably.
I noticed there was one clip where you could, you showed up in the mirror, since I know you edited, or did you edit this, I guess? You did.
Yes.
So you decided to keep that image in there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Actually, I mean, you can see myself in the mirror because when you look at the, that's not so evident in the center channel, but when you look at the three channels, my idea is that you, when you're watching this, you are as aware of the production as the fiction. And I wanted to create a tension between the kind of situation, the fact that this is something we're fictionalizing in a furniture store, and then the kind of internal fictions of their stories. So you, throughout the video, you're very aware of the production, and sometimes you kind of focus on that, and then sometimes you focus on the fiction, and there's this tension that's created between the two. And again, playing with the fiction and reality element. Yes.
How important was the fact that this was a soap opera? Because I know that soap operas in the States are very different than soap operas in Latin America. And was there any thought process for that?
Yes. Well, I mean, the kind of basic premise is that we consume a lot of the media. I mean, we watch a lot of TV, and we're highly influenced by, you know, watching movies and watching soap operas or whatever we watch. So in a way, we're already trained as actors, even if we don't know it. You know, we kind of have learned this language from watching so many hours. So, you know, soap operas in Latin America are different than here in some levels, but they're not that different. I mean, in the end, they are about, you know, love and betrayal, and it's kind of same basic kind of plots. You know, the rich girl that knows the poor girl that meets the rich guy, etc. So I don't think Dallas is that different from you know, the classic Mexican soap operas. But that was roughly what I was thinking about. And I, you know, I suspected, you know, we all have soap opera stories in our lives. So okay, any other question? Okay, so I'll move forward. Okay, so I will show Coyotería now, next. Okay, so Coyotería from 2003. This is the view of the installation. So this piece needs a little bit of background. This piece kind of it was born from this coincidence of two readings I was doing, completely unrelated readings that I was doing at the same time. On the one hand, I was reading about Joseph Beuys' piece, I Like America and America Likes Me. Is everyone familiarized with that piece, or should I briefly describe it? Basically, Joseph Beuys was a very influential German artist, and he came to the U.S., did this piece called I Like America and America Likes Me as a result of his first ever trip to the U.S. And basically, very roughly, he thought European culture has a spiritual side but also has a very greedy side to the culture. And in his mind, in Europe, the kind of greed had really overcome the spirituality of the culture. And his idea was that, you know, Europeans came to America and had a second chance here. But based on his first trip, his conclusion was that they blew it again. this, you know, basically quoting him. So he saw himself as some kind of shaman. I mean, he has like a shamanistic role. So the idea of this piece, I Like America and America Likes Me, was for him to come as some sort of like representative of European spirituality. And then he locked up himself with a coyote, like the animal coyote, for a whole week in a gallery in New York, and did this action in which he lived with the coyote as a way. And then so the coyote symbolized American spirituality. So for him, it was kind of a way of bringing together European and American spirituality. And at the same time I was reading about this piece, I was reading a book that is called, in Spanish it's called La Visión de los Vencidos, which is basically texts that were written by the defeated Aztecs after the conquest. So they're texts that were written in 16th century in which the Aztecs, talk about the defeat. And in one of them, the writer keeps using the symbol of the coyote to refer to the Spaniards. In other words, the coyote symbolized European greed. Because the Aztecs thought that they were, if they gave the Spaniards a lot of gold, they would eventually go. But they didn't have enough. You know, the more we gave them, the more they wanted to stay. So basically, it was very funny and ironic to me the fact that the coyote is used in this kind of diametrically opposed. It symbolizes these diametrically opposed ideas of, Native American spirituality as opposed to European greed. And so then, for this piece, in Mexico, the coyote, we still use the term coyote, although, it has evolved throughout the last 500 years. So it doesn't refer to European greed at all anymore, but it refers to middlemen and this kind of trickster character that would kind of navigate between legality and illegality. So, one of the very famous roles of the coyotes is to, cross people over the border. But in the context of Mexico City, you can hire a coyote to, I don't know, if you're underage and you want like a fake ID, then you would hire a coyote to get it for you. That sort of thing, So there is this building in Mexico City, and then outside of it, there's coyotes hanging out where you can just go and hire them. So I went to this building, I met a coyote, and then I basically asked him if he would be willing to reenact Joseph Beuys's piece, being playing an animal coyote. So it's like a human coyote playing the animal coyote for the piece. I could not find, I know there's a film that documented that action that I saw years ago in Canada, but I could not find it. But there's a really great book of photographs that has like hundreds of photographs of this. So then we kind of sat together and then looked through the book. And then based on this, we reenacted the piece with a lot of creative licenses. So I will play a little bit of the video, and then that's an installation view. So for every action that Beuys did, he used a lot of objects that had a very specific symbolism. So I studied what these objects were, and I kind of replaced them for my own. So in the installation, you have the video, and then all the relics from the performance. So here it goes.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's Coyotería. Any questions, or should I move forward? Yes.
Did you do it for a whole week?
No, I didn't do it for a whole week. Actually, I performed this 3 times. The first time, which was the one for the shoot, I did it in my studio, and we did it like for about 2 hours. I respected that kind of structure. And then I did it, that was very funny, we did it for the Miami Basel Art Fair. And the opening there is super long because they have many openings, one after the other, like for the, collectors and VIP and whatever. So there we did like 10 hours straight. So we would just fall asleep. I would under the blanket fall asleep for a while and then keep going. So that was very long. And then finally I did it at a space in New York called Apex Art. So, but and that was shorter. The longest was the Miami Basel one. Okay. Yes.
You said that each of the objects or paraphernalia in the performance has specific meaning for you. So I'm just wondering why the shaman now is for you for using a police baton.
Sure. Joseph Beuys used a cane that is curved in the end. So for him, it kind of symbolized the flow of energy with this curve at the end. And then I replaced that with the police baton because in a way, my comment is that even with his shamanistic intervention, it didn't make much of a difference. So the piece really is about, kind of alienation between humans and alienation between humans and the natural world. So that's why I decided to replace it for this, for the police baton in that case. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will now eject. So should I, we have 18 minutes left. Should I jump to Octopus or should I show one other piece before?
I have one more piece.
Yes? Okay. Loading. There we go. Okay. So, any requests? Since I cannot show them all. Okay. I'll show Gaza Strip. Oh, okay. It's running. I didn't press play, but it's running, so I'll leave it to her. So this one has no sound, so I can speak over it. So in 2006, I was invited to the Herzliya Museum of Contemporary Art in Israel, which is the main contemporary art museum. And they invited me to go for a month to Israel to, be there and then go back 6 months later to produce a piece based on my experience. So they wanted some level of specificity, site specificity in the work. And when I went there, I kind of thought to myself, okay, there's no way I'm going to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because, well, that's a little distracting. Let me. Oh, there. I'll pause it. That's a good steal. Okay, so so I thought to myself, I'm going to try to avoid that subject. I think there's like an obsession in the world with that conflict, and we hear way too much about it. There's so many conflicts in the world, and I'm sure in a country there's many things that I can talk about, etc. But when I arrived there, it was exactly when Israel was disengaging from the Gaza Strip. So there was a huge opposition against the pullout from a lot of the population, and then from others, like a lot of support. And it was impossible to ignore. Like I tried, and it was just not possible to not really think about that. And mostly the people that were against the pullout were incredibly vocal and very violent. Like there were even some cases of people that had blue ribbons, which symbolized the ones that wanted to pull out, that they got their car smashed for having the blue ribbons in their car. And anyway, so the people that were against had these orange ribbons. So anyway, I went, you know, back to Mexico and started thinking about what could I do. And then I, you know, thought, okay, what if I make a piece that does not address this issue in political terms or in the way we're used to discussing politics, and that addresses it like almost from the perspective of like a four-year-old kid, that it's not politicized. In other words, how can I make a piece that in a way is about the kind of energy that I felt being there and this kind of tension without really entering the kind of political debate in a literal way? And also, how can I bring humor into this subject? Because, I mean, as you can imagine, it's something, you know, an issue that, you know, nobody's laughing about it there. So I decided then to, you know, came up with this very dumb idea of the Gaza Stripper. And then I asked the curator in the museum, can you please put an ad in the paper looking for a male stripper? And she was very nice and supportive, and she put the ad. And then in the 6 months following, you know, in between my next, you know, trip, there was only one person that that replied the ad, but I could not have asked for more. So this guy, you know, kind of showed up. And then we did it throughout the opening. I'll show you. Let me go back to the menu. It doesn't want to stop. Come on. Well, it won't go away. Okay, so I'll show you an installation view. So basically, so the space was quite big, so I created this kind of stage-like sculpture in which I had, in each one of the arms that you can see sticking out, I had a camera and a TV monitor pointing up. So during the opening, which was quite a long opening, the cameras were pointing at the stage and recording him. And then once that night was over, during the duration of the show, I think it was 2 months, over 2 months, you could just see the structure and then the video that was recorded during the opening in the 8 channels all around. Anyway, so this was a very official opening. The Mexican embassy was giving support to the exhibition, so the Mexican ambassador was there, and the mayor of the city was there. So I'll play the video, and then I'll tell you more about the opening. So you can... So he was wearing headphones, so you went in there and you could not listen to the music. Like, he's the only one that listened to the music. So it was like an incredibly kind of like abject situation, and then nobody approached the stage. Like, people kind of kept drinking their wine, were like kind of pushed to the corner, really far from the stage, and really looking away. It was kind of hard to look at. And the opening was kind of intense. At some point, there were like a TV crew there, and then a lot of the public started attacking the mayor of the city and basically telling her that why is she wasting their tax money in that kind of shit, and that that was not art. And so the mayor kind of came to my defense, saying that they should be self-critical, and the Mexican ambassador also jumped, and it was kind of a very heated opening. It was a lot of fun. And then the TV crew started accusing me for being anti-Semite, and I basically told them, can you please explain to me how am I being anti-Semitic? And then, they really couldn't articulate it. So, I guess I did achieve to create in that opening this kind of tension that I felt in the streets, which in a way was the point. So anyway, that's the Gaza Stripper. And the museum had skylights, so as it was getting later in the opening, it started getting darker, and you could see more of the disco lights. Okay, that's the end of it. All right. Any more questions about Gaza Strip? Okay, first here.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about white artists that are increasing kind of absurd humor in New York?
Absurd humor? I think humor is a really great way of gaining like critical distance from ourselves and from our culture. So I usually deal with issues that are not really pleasant, and issues that are not the kind of things that we like to think about. So humor, I found that humor is a really great way of on the one hand, getting some critical distance, but at the same time, once we're laughing, we're implicated. So in a way, it's a double kind of agenda of, on the one hand, not letting people disassociate from what they're watching, but at the same time, give that kind of critical distance that, you need. I really love this moment in which, you're laughing at something and then you realize what you're laughing at, and it's kind of ask yourself, why am I laughing at that? And that kind of psychological moment that I'm really interested in. So I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. There was another question back here. Okay.
So I'm going to guess that this guy's not a professional stripper, right?
So that's right.
Did you find out anything about him? I'm just intrigued by, who is this guy?
He was super nice, and I guess some people like to perform. Some people like to be in front of their cameras, and kind of as an end in itself. I think that was mostly his motivation, And he was great. I told him, ignore everyone and just get into your world, and he was good. So. Yes. I mean, he had a regular work. He was not in the art world or anything like that. He was just a regular job, yes.
I had a question. I was going to ask this earlier. Can you talk about the impact of studying at UCLA? I was thinking of Paul McCarthy in particular. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, I mean, he is definitely an artist that influenced me a lot, and I like his work a lot. Some of the works I've shown here, I did pre-going to school, and some are after. So, you know, he's someone that I worked with a lot. When I went to grad school, it was his last 2 years of teaching, and he decided to devote a lot of time to teach before he retired from teaching. So I don't know what to say beyond that. I mean, I really like his work a lot, and I really like his use of humor, and I'm interested in some of the same issues in some levels, in others not. But I don't know if that answers the question at all, or if you have a more specific role there. But he's definitely a big influence for sure. Was there another one? No, I think that's it.
Okay.
Okay, so 5 minutes to the hour. Should I go to Octopus? Okay, so I'm sure everyone here has seen Octopus in the exhibition. Has anyone not seen it? Do I need to show it? One person. Are we democratic or not? I'll put it in the background with no sound so that I can speak over it and you can see it. But I'll talk about it anyway. So, one of the second piece in the exhibition is called Octopus, and Octopus is a piece that I originally did as a result of a residency I did with the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles. So the Hammer Museum invited me to do a research-based residency, and hold on. Okay. Well, that's too bad I didn't get to show that piece. If we have time, I'll show it. Come on. Okay, so the Hammer invited me, and then while I was there, I was reading a book by a friend of mine that is called The Art of Political Murder. And my intention in the residency was to work on a piece that was about Los Angeles, about an aspect of Los Angeles. I really wanted to interact with the city, and also I had lived there, so it's a city that I, you know, more know quite a bit. So I, by coincidence, I was reading this book when I arrived there. I was finishing it, called The Art of Political Murder. And it's a book by a writer from New York called Francisco Goldman. And his mother is Guatemalan. So when he, in the 80s, he was like a war correspondent in Guatemala. And then he wrote this book about the murder of a bishop that was like a very important human rights activist there. And in the book, he gave a very good background of a very good context for the Guatemalan Civil War, and the involvement of the U.S. in that in the coup d'état that happened in 1954, and then the following dictatorship. I remembered when I was reading this book that at some point I had been to this Home Depot parking lot and hired there a Guatemalan worker who was a guerrilla fighter. Like, he even showed me like his like bullet wounds in his stomach, and he had fought in the Civil War. So then I realized that some of the characters I was reading about actually live in LA today. So I decided to go back to this Home Depot parking lot. And I don't know if that's the case in Texas, but in California, the parking lots of the Home Depot is where the undocumented workers gather to be hired as day laborers. So in the context of California, if you talk about the Home Depot parking lot, there's an immediate association with undocumented workers. So I had hired one of these guys. So then I went back to the parking lot and I started doing interviews. And then I actually found one that had fought in the war. I couldn't find the same guy that had worked that I had hired. And we went, and then he helped me find other Guatemalans who had fought in the war. So the idea was that, based on the tradition that's very common here of Civil War reenactments, which we also have in Mexico. For instance, we have, like, in Puebla, the Cinco de Mayo reenactment of that battle. So based on that, I decided to make a reenactment of the Guatemalan Civil War with the actual people that had fought in the war. So as opposed to these hobbyists, they're the actual ex-fighters, and as opposed to doing this reenactment in the actual battlefield where the battle took place, I'm kind of relocating it to the Home Depot parking lot. So that's the story behind the piece. Do you have any questions at this point? Yes, I wanted to alter the location as little as possible. So I did not get permission from the Home Depot. I mean, I don't think they would have given it to me anyway. So, but also I didn't want to alter the context. And since these guys are there every day, everyone is very used to their presence. So I didn't know how much these kind of actions, the war kind of reenactment, would have altered the scenario, but it turned out, as you can see in the videos, that very little. You know, people hardly paid attention. Like, everyone just kind of went on their own business. So yes, that's yes. It's specifically choreographed. I even actually did like storyboards and very specific drawings, because since I knew that I would not have much control of the context of the environment, I had no permit, so I did not know what to expect. And also, there's cars coming in and out. I mean, it's already a very chaotic location with many elements that I'm not controlling as a director. So I wanted to make sure that I had like a very, very well coordinated and choreographed situation happening there. So I knew exactly where the cameras were, you know, supposed to be placed at. I had very specific direction both for the cameraman and for the actors. But all of their actions are based on what they showed me. Like, I have never fought in a war, so. Previously, before the shoot, I did some rehearsals with them, and then they show me, they talk to me about what is a war like. They said, you know, there's a lot of waiting, and, you know, it's not, you know, if you have not been in the war, you think of action. But, you know, they say it's a lot of, like, nothing happening and just waiting and patrolling. And they also show me the moves that I didn't know. So I ended up, you know, making my choreography based on the movements that they showed me. Yes.
First of all, this wasn't my question, but right now, because they're talking, what language are they?
Yes, they all are Mayans, so their mother tongue is Mayan. I also wanted to stress that aspect, that to me it's very important. So in this part of the video, everything, of course, it's an abstraction of like the war movements. And in that part, there's a part where they patrol, where they put themselves back to back with the rifles and they rotate. So I, you know, did that one, but on top of that, in that specific scene, I asked them to talk about the war in their mother tongue. So, you know, they all speak Quechua. And they were speaking in Quechua about that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So, Octopus, besides the iconic scene where they're all in the dolly, they're onto all that, what else, is there something else meaning to that title?
Yes. The meaning of the title comes from the United Fruit Company, because the United Fruit Company, nowadays Chiquita Banana, played a very important role in that war. And basically, the United Fruit Company in Guatemala was nicknamed the Octopus, because they pretty much had their hands on everything. They were like the biggest landowners in Guatemala, and they had like a monopoly of the ports. That's where the title comes from. It's like a reference. Back there, and then Rafael.
A lot of your work, the actors, seems like it's very emotional. Did any of the people afterwards say they were affected in any way? Like, did they express to you how they felt afterwards? Like, maybe it affected them? Like, especially the Coyote or these people, like, going sure. back and reenacting those things, did it affect them
yes.
in any way?
Well, the Coyote is a very cynical guy, so I don't think he was very effective. You know, he basically does that for a living. I mean, he's like, you know, he gets paid to make whatever you need him to make. So for him, it was almost business as usual. Not quite, but almost. For these guys, I think they were very happy, and that's one of the reasons why I made the piece, because in L.A., they are completely, their histories are completely ignored in the context of L.A. Nobody knows who they are, where they come from. They could be Mexican or whatever. You know, nobody knows they're specifically from Guatemala. Nobody knows that they're Mayan, that, you know, Spanish is not even their mother tongue, and people call them Hispanic, which I think is very ironic. In a way, for them, it was really great, because the piece acknowledged who they are and their histories and really their identities. So they, at first, when I approached them, they were kind of very afraid, because it was a moment when it was very hot with the immigration issues, and they thought I was kind of coming after them. And then once it became clear that that was not what I was about, then they opened up and they were really into the piece. They participated in a really active way, and they were really, really into it. To me, it's very important. To me, the real subjects, or the main subjects, are not them, but the people around them and the reaction of the people around them. So also, they I think they got that, and they were into the project. They kind of liked what we were doing. Rafa here.
You made the part to just answer the book. In a lot of the film, the scene is vacant, and the actors can just see all the randoms walking by. So what role do you specifically see outside of this play?
Yeah, like I said, to me, the role of the outsider is very, very important. I mean, the fact that these guys are almost invisible, it's very important to me. And it kind of reflects a psychology of in this country, you know, the fact that these kind of issues are pretty much denied. Not denied, but evaded. You know, it's the kind of issues that, you know, we don't think about much in the everyday life, you know, and you know, hardly anyone even knows the fact that, you know, that the U.S. invaded Guatemala, for instance. So it's their invisibility that it's very important. And there's a scene coming up that I think reflects that very strongly. It looks kind of dangerous with the cars, but not so much. We had like people stopping the traffic in these scenes particularly. So I think it looks a lot more dangerous than what it was.
What about the editing?
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of the pieces that I showed are kind of earlier pieces, but in the later works that I have been making in the last few years, I have been thinking a lot more about the relationship of the body and video, and thinking about video in a more sculptural way, in a physical way, you know, not as a flat medium, but as a physical medium. And to me, in this piece in particular, I really was thinking in terms of immersion. Like for me, it was very important that you are immersed. So of course, we're looking at the four channels. Oh, this is the scene I was talking about. Let me just pause it for a second. It's very important for me that you're kind of feel kind of immersed by the piece when you walk in there. So your physical relationship to the video is very important. So that's why there's like, you know, this kind of synchronicity amongst the channels, and it's something that I have been working in the few last few years with a lot. Exactly, and connecting the video to the architecture and to your own physicality, your own physical body, so that, you know, you're kind of playing physically a role in the experience of watching it, and you're not kind of looking from a distance, which is also conceptually what the work is about. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Did you guys volunteer their time to do this, or did you pay them also?
I pay them, yeah. In every case, I always pay the people that participate, and I try to explain as much as possible what the art context is like, the fact that I might be able to sell the works. And so I do pay them for their time. In you know, how much I paid varies with the budget that I have. In this case, fortunately, the Hammer was producing the piece, so I had a decent budget, and I could pay them, you know, maybe like four times as much as they would make in a day of work. So yeah, I definitely pay them. So this is the scene that I was talking about. For instance, in this case, the cameras were inside of cars, so there was no way for anyone to tell that this was like a video shoot happening. And these guys kind of died outside of the sheds. To be honest, not as much. Not as much. I mean, in a way, this is what I was expecting, but I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm. I have one question.
Sure.
Are those two different groups? One are black and the other is white, and you purposely chose them so they would be one separate group?
Yes, that's because some were ex-military and others were ex-guerrillas. So that was like a subtle way of differentiating this fact. Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's the reason behind the white, black and white. Mm-hmm. Yes, back there.
How long did it take to film this?
I shot this in two sessions. First session was 6 hours long until I got kicked out because, again, I didn't have a permit, so I went there and then maybe like half an hour after we started, the guards from the Home Depot spotted us, and they came. And then I basically explained to them what was I doing. And they were very sympathetic, and they said, okay, if our supervisor comes, then you have to leave. And then maybe like 2 hours later, the supervisor came, and I also talked him into letting us do it. He was like also sympathetic and liked liked it. And he was like, okay, stay here, but when my supervisor comes, then you really have to go. So then 6 hours later, the supervisor of the supervisor came, and she really, really violently kicked us out. So then we had to leave, and I only had left to do the shed scene, the last scene we saw, and some of the shots of the signs and the ones of the parking lot lines, you know, of the cement, the pavement. So then I went another day without the actors and did all the pavement shots and the signs and all the establishing shots. And then only with two of the actors that did the shed scene. And then I saw it, luckily the same guards were there, and they were like, oh no, you again. So then I begged them. I was like, please, this scene will take like, you know, 20 minutes and you will never see me again, I promise. And they were super nice, like they let me do it. And also the one of the sheds is the one that's closer to the entrance and the one that's really like was more difficult for that reason. And then they let me do it, and then they never saw me again. So, yes.
What was the reaction to this piece when you showed it in Guatemala?
Well, I mean, originally I didn't really care so much about showing it in Guatemala because to me this is a piece about the U.S., not about Guatemala. But then it turned out that there's these really, really great guys in Guatemala that have a gallery called Proyectos Ultravioleta, and they invited me to show there, and they really wanted me to show the piece. And I had never been to Guatemala, so I also, again, did not know much what to expect. So I went there, and I gave a really long talk, and I showed the piece, and it was incredible. I'm very, very happy I did. Because, you know, in Guatemala, the whole war was so incredibly brutal that people are not really talking about these issues. And it turns out that now they're just starting to really address this issue, like younger generations. It was so traumatizing that you know, it was kind of very, you know, nobody really talked about politics and about the situation that much. So it was really great. I really, you know, was happy that I showed it there. And there was like a really long and intense debate after when I gave the talk, and you know, people had seen the exhibition. So I'm happy I did. And they invited me now to go back and do a new piece down there. So I might do Octopus Part 2. The Octopus Returns. Yes. During the Home Depot shoot?
Yes.
No, nobody called the police. Yes, I mean in general, as you could see, people didn't really care. And I mean, we were a little bit in the way of the cars, but you know, it's such a big parking lot that the cars could go around. So it was only an issue for the guards because they could get in trouble. So once the guards agreed, then it was fine. So nobody called the police on us, fortunately, because LA police is scary. Yes.
One more question. Are the banana companies still on charge as they were, or how?
I think that has changed, yes. I mean, it is bad now in the sense that, I mean, for instance, I was reading the other day that from mining, Guatemala only keeps 1% of the, how you call it, the profit from mining. So generally speaking, the situation is the same, but there's different players, of course. And I know Chiquita Banana still exists, but I know that they don't still play that big role that they used to. But all in all, I mean, it's still in a country that's very much exploited by outside, you know, companies. So it's very poor. Oh, it's. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes.
There's always some element of performance or theatrical improvisation, and yet on the other side, there's always this kind of filmic aspect, and I wonder for you, like, where the work is. Like, is all the like the artwork itself? Like, is it always in the end result, in the video piece, in the installation, or did it exist in the performance or the kind of incorporation that happened at the beginning too?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the work is also happening right now in this format. So, in other words, I mean, what I do, I consider it to be a hybrid amongst performance, video, and installation. And I would not put one above the other. And I also think, you know, it has many different stages or life kind of moments in which the piece is alive in different ways. So I do see this as a performance. I mean, if you were happening to walk by in that parking lot that day and saw this performance, even if you didn't know what it was, to me, that's already, the piece is already activated. And I consider that to be the piece as much as the installation in the museum. So so it's very, very hybrid, and in a way it's has many different moments in which it gets activated in different ways. So did that answer the question? Yes. Okay. We're done?
Thank you.